There is a bit of that in this period, although it's worth saying that there is a reason for that. The reason they talk so much about angels is actually because they want to try and talk about God, but they don't want to do it in irreverent terms, and so they think, well, angels are a spiritual being, and so we can kind of talk about them without worrying that we're going to kind of cross over things we shouldn't be saying about God. So that's often why they speculate about angels, but if you know anything about this period, as I say, you might think that what they do is sit around and kind of speculate slightly randomly. However, that is not the case. The best thinkers of this period, what they are doing is doing theology as worship. They are seeing their study of God as helping them to adore their God. Their aim is, as that introduction states, to shape minds, nourish hearts, and change lives. They recognize that Romans 12 says that we are transformed by the renewing of our minds. And so, they speak to the mind, but they don't stop with the mind. Bernard is someone we'll meet a bit later. Bernard, he says this of preaching. Preaching is not so much to explain words as it is to reach hearts. His desire in all the theology that he does is to reach hearts, to nourish hearts. And to do that, that would change people's lives. They desire that people would see God truly so that they can live rightly. And that should always be our aim as well. That is, our aim should never be to, on the one hand, neglect thinking, nor on the other hand, to stop with thinking. There's the danger of neglecting thinking, because what you do is you end up letting false teaching in, and you start creating God as you want him to be rather than as the scriptures reveal him to be. We need to be alert to make sure we think. But also we need to not see thinking as the end goal, because as Paul reminds us, knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. And so as we look into this thing, we seek to be those who think, but with the aim of nourishing hearts and changing lives. That's what the theologians of that period were doing. That's what we're going to seek to do this afternoon. You might ask, why this topic in this period? Why are we gazing at the great God with this period of history? A couple of reasons. Number one, because we try, where possible, to tie some of our church history into our vision verse for the year. So that works well to do it this way this time. But also because it is a period where there is a lot of good thinking done about who our God is. And so, it is a useful thing to see what they had to say. What we're going to do this afternoon, then, we're going to look at three major theologians from this period. The structure we're going to work with is kind of work with one at a time in historical order. And with each of them, we're basically going to look at a clause of our vision verse, roughly. With the first, we're going to think about how the Lord is great, and so on and so forth. All of these theologians get some stuff wrong as well. We're not going to dive particularly into that today, partly because, as we said at the beginning of the series, a lot of the errors the church makes in the Middle Ages are better suited to kind of being worked through as we start to think about the Reformation, which, God willing, we'll come back to when we next come back to this series. So come back next year and find out the things they get wrong. But here's some things they get right that will really help us. We're first going to think about Anselm. Anselm was born in 1033. So Anselm's kind of our 11th century guy. He was born in Italy, and he became a monk in Normandy. That is significant because he is a monk in Normandy in the 1060s. And if your history is good, you know that a man comes from Normandy in the 1060s and does something very significant. His name is William, the Conqueror. And so, what happens is this man Anselm, who is known to William, end up becoming quite significant because he is known to the person who ends up taking over the British Isles and generally conquering where he goes. Anselm ends up becoming the Archbishop of Canterbury in 1093. Worth saying, he didn't want to be, he was forced to be, he didn't like it, he fought against it, but eventually he is made Archbishop of Canterbury. He writes a few different works. There are three particularly that he's known for. You don't need to know these particularly, but just for if you are interested. There's the Monologion. What he's seeking to do in that is to reason his way to what God is like. He's saying, if I just use reason, can I work out what God must logically be like? The proslogion, which is what we're going to lean on most, similar, but he's doing that more devotionally as a kind of prayer to God. And then his most famous work is called Cur Deus Homo, which is Latin for why God man. And it is a kind of study in why is it that God has to take on flesh? Why the incarnation? Anselm dies in 1109. With Anselm, though, we're going to see that the Lord is great. Particularly, we're going to work with Anselm's insight that God is the greatest and only perfect being. God is the greatest and only perfect being. See, in Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is speaking and he says, "Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." And Anselm picks up that thought and says, if God is perfect, what must he be like? And over the course of his writings, he grapples with that and tries to work out, for God to be perfect, what is perfection? And from there, he starts to build a picture of what God is like. There's a couple of descriptions of God, which he's fairly well known for. It's one of the most famous things he said about God. One we quoted a few weeks ago as we were preaching through Psalm 145. That's the first on your handouts. God is a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. It's quite a complicated phrase, but I think it's a helpful one. So let's just work it through. God is a being. God exists. But he is a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. That is, whatever you can imagine, God is greater. However great a picture you can put in your head of what God could possibly be like, God is greater than that picture. However big your imagination, however grand your imagination, whatever you build up in your imagination of what God is like, God is greater than whatever you can possibly think of. God is a greater being than any human can possibly even imagine. That's one way that Anselm describes God. Here's another. God is whatever it is better to be than not to be. God is whatever it is better to be than not to be. If so, it is good to be something, God is that. If it is bad to be something, God is not that. And that's how it works. To work out who God is, what he's like, is it good to be that thing? If so, God is that and he is that perfectly. Is it bad to be that thing? In which case, God is nothing like that, has never been and never will be. God is whatever it is better to be than not to be. Those two quotes, I think, capture some of Anselm's grasp of the greatness of God. This utterly perfect being, greater than anyone you can even imagine, never mind anyone who actually exists. Having all the things it is good to be in their utter fullness. God is truly great. Little asterisk on those two quotes. They are really helpful. They are slightly dangerous. Anselm is very restrained in how he uses them, but the little danger is that basically both of them say, could be read as saying, I can sit there and I can work out what I think is good, and if I think it's good, God must be that. And we start creating God in our own image. That is not what Anselm is doing, but it's just worth noting that those quotes mishandled can imply that basically I just get to sit there and I get to decide what's good, and therefore I can define God. That is not what Anselm has in his mind. Instead, he is looking at objective standards of goodness and beauty and saying, God is those things perfectly, always. But for Anselm, that thinking that helps him to understand that God is this incredibly great being never stops with thinking. Instead, here's what he says at one point. If the created life is good, how good is the creative life? If there are many delights in delectable, that it just means delightful, things. What and how great is the delight in him who made these delectable things? Do you see what he's saying? If the created life is good, that is the life we live in this world, the life that God has made, if this is good, how much better is the life of the one who is the creative one, the one who created those things? If the created life is good, how much better the creative life? If there are many delights in this world, if there are things that we can taste and delight in and rejoice in and love, how great is the one who made those things? See, for Anselm, this grasp of God's greatness is never meant to just stop with some head knowledge. It leads to delight in the goodness of God, We delight in the one who made these delectable things. Anselm sees that God is truly great, greater than any other being. And that leads to delight and praise. We're going to spend some time in groups now. There's a quote for the sake of the recording. I'm going to read it out. And then there's a couple of questions to discuss. It's a relatively involved quote. So let me read it, and then a couple of questions. Anselm says of God, "Truly, thou art life, thou art wisdom, thou art truth, thou art goodness, thou art blessedness, thou art eternity, and thou art every true good. Many are these attributes. My restricted understanding cannot see so many at one view, cannot see so many at once, that it may be gladdened by all at once." Okay, two questions. What is Anselm saying here? And if you get completely baffled, stick up a hand and I can come and help. Are there ways, and this will probably hint towards what he's saying, are there ways in which our inability to see all that God is leaves us somewhat paralyzed in seeing his greatness? I think that makes sense as a question. Again, if it doesn't, pop up a hand. But 5 minutes or so to discuss those couple of things in groups. That's the kind of pattern we'll follow. We'll think a little bit about each of these thinkers, then we'll have some time in groups. We won't feed back, particularly this afternoon. I don't know where you kind of got to in groups. I think why I found that quote really helpful is because maybe you've never had this moment. Maybe this is unique to me, but I'm guessing it probably isn't. Maybe it is, though. You sit down to pray and you go to give God thanks for who he is. And kind of there's so many things you could thank God for that you end up actually just very quickly running out of knowing what to say so you don't actually say anything. Like I say, that might be a unique experience that I've had, though there are enough nods that maybe go, that isn't unique to me. I find that quote exceptionally helpful to go, that's kind of always going to be how it is. Like, God is so great that I'm never going to be able to sit down and grasp all of his greatness in all of its different aspects all in one go, and I shouldn't expect to. And so it's okay if I sit down to pray and go, do you know, all I can do today is think about God's wisdom. That's all I'm going to think about. I'm not even going to exhaust that, never mind the other attributes. But there are so many things we could thank God for that we end up doing none. And I think this just quite helps me to think that's actually what we should expect to happen as we reflect on the things of the Lord. That's Anselm. He helps us to see great is the Lord. Our second theologian over the page, Bernard of Clairvaux. He helps to see that God is most worthy of love. There's the one difference to the vision verse, if you're alert to such things. This is Bernard's big emphasis, so it didn't quite perfectly map, so we're going to go with his emphasis rather than trying to crowbar the psalm onto everything. Bernard of Clairvaux is born in 1090. He is born in France, and his dad is one of the knights who goes on the First Crusade and recaptures Jerusalem in 1099. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, we thought about those crusades. And that is that kind of formative experience in Bernard's childhood is part of why, if you remember, we had that quote about taking up your cross and going to kind of fight the crusades. That was him. And part of why is, I think, because he saw his dad go and recapture Jerusalem and heard those stories growing up as a child. That kind of thing that we saw he said a couple of weeks ago, which we rightly kind of said that's actually not very helpful, might jar a bit with actually most of Bernard's emphases. It is slightly hard to work out how he said that while he says all these wonderful things as well. Anyway, Bernard becomes a monk. Bernard sets up a monastery, and his monastery is so successful that it's kind of spawns lots of other monasteries and ends up with hundreds of monasteries across Europe by the time that he dies. Bernard is renowned as a great preacher of his time. People speak of his sermons as dripping with the love of Christ. And it is that idea of love that is at the heart of everything that Bernard says, does, thinks. Three of his major works, Steps of Humility and Pride, helping to think through that issue. He wrote an extensive commentary on Song of Songs. That's his most famous works, what he's most well known for. He famously understands Song of Songs as this kind of big allegory of the marriage between Christ and his church, and he goes into great depths with every verse to help us see how that shows us the wonder of our ultimate husband, Christ, and how we as his bride, the church, are to respond. However, the work we're going to think most about, and I'll try and send that out as a PDF with the church email tomorrow because it's pretty short, is called On Loving God. It's about 25, 30 pages, I think, from memory. And he has loads of fantastic insights, amongst some bits that are quite confusing. I'm not going to pretend that's not true. But loads of fantastic insights of what it looks like to love God. And here, I think, is the thing he would want us most to know. Here's one thing he says. The reason for loving God is God himself. The reason for loving God is God himself. He has lots of really helpful insights. But here are three insights that he has. We're going to think about the progression of our love of God, the insufficiency of our love of God, and the result of our love of God. First, the progression of our love of God. Bernard thinks about what it is to kind of grow in the Christian life, and he talks about it as kind of when you're not a Christian, you are loving yourself and you are doing it for your own sake. You are just interested in yourself. You're turned in on yourself. That is what sin does. And he talks of becoming a Christian in terms of kind of turning towards loving God. But here's the particular insight I think he has that is really helpful. He recognizes that you don't simply flip from loving yourself to loving God. There is this kind of middle stage, which he describes as loving God selfishly or loving God for your own sake. And in this stage, we do genuinely love God and he wants to commend that, but also we kind of love God because of the stuff God gives us. We love God because he saves me. We love God because he's given me that family or he's given me that job or that house, or Bernard would have used other examples, but that kind of thing. There's a real sense of a genuine love for God, but there is also a kind of selfish element of that love. And Bernard recognizes that is part of the trajectory of growth in the Christian life. As the Spirit works, he will turn us from loving self to loving God for our sake to ultimately loving God as God for God's sake. He helps us to see that that is just a very natural thing. And it's not that you kind of, you're in box one and then you move to box two and eventually you make it to box three. But actually over the course of your Christian life, you're kind of in all of those in different ways at different times. As the Spirit sanctifies you, as you grow in repentance and faith, there are ways in which you will be in all of these places. And with that ultimate aspiration of coming to the point where we love God as God for God's sake. I just found that as I reflected on that this week, just really helpful. Because firstly, I think it describes a lot of what we experience, but also because it pastorally helps us with those moments where we go, I do genuinely want the Lord to be honored here, but I'd also quite like to get a bit of credit along the way. Those moments, I think, are really helpfully explained by this diagram, saying, it's not that in that moment I don't love God, I genuinely do, but also I don't love him perfectly as God for his own sake. There is mixed motives going on within me, and part of sanctification is praying that the Spirit would move me to not just love God, but to love God as God for God's own sake. Bernard helps us to see there is a progression in our love for God. It isn't just an on-off switch. Secondly, Bernard helps us to see the insufficiency of our love of God. Again, one of those quotes that's quite a lot to take in, but I'll read it and then I'll talk it through. My God and my help, I will love thee for thy great goodness. I cannot love thee as thou deservest to be loved. For I cannot love thee more than my own feebleness permits. I will love thee more when thou deemest me worthy to receive greater capacity for loving, yet never so perfectly as thou hast deserved of me. God is most worthy of our love. And we do love him. But as Bernard articulates, we cannot love God as God deserves to be loved. We can love him, but not as much as he deserves. We cannot love him more than our own feebleness permits. And by that, I think he is talking both about the weakness of the human condition and our inherent finite nature, but also about our sin. We are not able to love God as we ought to do, as he deserves. And then he goes on to say, I will love you more when you deem me worthy to receive greater capacity for loving. It's a really striking sentence, isn't it? I will love you more when you deem me worthy to give me greater capacity to love you. That is to say, there is nothing in me inherently that enables me to love God. Instead, what I need is for God to grow my capacity to love him by the power of the Spirit. And that is an honor of which someone is deemed worthy. That is, it is a privilege to be able to love God. There is nothing better for a human than to know God and love God. And so the greatest honor God can bestow, or maybe not the greatest, a very great honor God can bestow on people is a growth in the ability to love him. Because that is what we're made for. We will love God more when God deems us worthy to give us greater capacity to love him, but we will never love God as perfectly as God deserves. God is so worthy of our love that we will never love him as much as he deserves to be loved. But we will love him, and we will grow in love him as he, by the Spirit, deems us worthy to grow our capacity to love him. Our love for God is ultimately insufficient, and yet it's a remarkable privilege that we can love him. Thirdly, the result of our love of God. Here again is Bernard. What could result from the contemplation of compassion so marvelous and so undeserved? Favor so free and so well attested? Kindness so unexpected? Mercy so unconquerable? Grace so amazing? Except that the soul should withdraw from all sinful affections, reject all that is inconsistent with God's love, and yield herself wholly to heavenly things. We thought at the beginning about how the point of theology is not just to fill our heads. Do you see Bernard's emphasis there? As we contemplate God, the one whose compassion is so marvelous and undeserved, whose favor is so free, whose kindness is so unexpected, whose mercy is so unconquerable, whose grace is so amazing, as we gaze on him, what should the result be? That we withdraw from sinful affections, that our lives are changed because our heart has been gripped by someone greater, that we recognize that things that are inconsistent with God's love are just not worth our energy, our effort, our time. Because God is so much greater. And so we give ourselves more wholly to heavenly things. Maybe an illustration will help with that thought. Orange juice tastes delicious unless you've just brushed your teeth. What Bernard is basically saying is sin is like orange juice and gazing on God is like brushing your teeth. In that, sin tastes good until you gaze on God, at which point your taste buds are changed and sin tastes revolting to you. You see? You see the mapping? Just as when you brush your teeth, your taste buds are changed so orange juice is no longer sweet to the taste. So too, as we taste of God's heavenly goodness, sin tastes horrible to us. We gaze on God, we see more of his goodness. Why? Because he deserves it, because he warrants it, but also because it will cause us to lose our taste for our sinful affections. Sin will no longer appeal to us in the way that it did. And so we are to gaze on God. We are to love God. We are to see his loveliness because that is what will motivate us in our battle with sin. We do not battle sin by just staring at sin. We battle sin by staring at God. As we taste of his heavenly goodness, sin tastes horrible to us. Back into discussion groups. A couple of questions in the light of what Bernard's had to say. Which element of Bernard's teaching on loving God has struck you most? How might what you've heard change your approach to God? 5 or 6 minutes to do that. Conversations. We've met Anselm in the 11th century. We've met Bernard in the 12th century. We're going to meet Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. And Thomas Aquinas is going to help us to see that God's greatness no one can fathom. A little bit of an introduction to Aquinas. He is born in 1225 to a noble family. He grows up in a castle. Lucky him. You know what's so funny? Alison just laughed when I said, grew up in a castle. And that threw me off. Anyway, good. One of the really significant things that happens around the time that Aquinas is alive is that Aristotle's works, Aristotle, famous Greek philosopher of the past, his works are translated from Greek to Latin, and that means that now people in the West can access them in the way they haven't historically. Aquinas is kind of part of that wave of people who is reading Aristotle, and what he seeks to do is to kind of systematize and blend Christianity, the scriptures, with this philosophy of Aristotle, if that all sounds kind of way up there and the kind of thing that's completely confusing, that's totally fine. You don't need to remember that, but it's just a bit of background for him. In his most famous work called Summa Theologica, which is huge, and we're talking like 3,000 pages, which actually he wrote by hand, and couldn't just go back and edit it. He unpacks a kind of system of theology. So he kind of goes issue by issue, topic by topic, and he handles it in this very specific way where what he'll do is he'll take a topic. So let's say, for example, he takes the goodness of God. And what he'll do is he'll break down the goodness of God into kind of 8 or 10 or 12 or whatever, different questions. And for each question, he will kind of lay out all the objections people have to the standard Christian answer to that question. He'll then respond with a quote, normally from the scriptures or from Augustine or occasionally from Aristotle. Then he'll write a paragraph that kind of unpacks that as to why that is the right view. And then he kind of one by one answers each of the objections that he originally laid out. Then he moves on to the next question, he does it again, and then he moves on to the next topic. And it is just this extensive work as someone who sits and thinks deeply about these things. It's 3,000 pages. He never finished it. So in 1273, a very mysterious thing happened. December of 1273, we don't know what happened. We just know that there was some incident in Aquinas' life that after that he decided to never write a single word ever again. We don't know why. He dies the next year, and so he never finishes writing this great systematic work. Others of his kind of pupils and stuff try to kind of guess how he would have finished it off, and that's often what you get at the end of it. With Aquinas, we're going to think about that thought that God's greatness no one can fathom. We're going to think particularly about the thought that God is utterly different from us. God is completely different from us. Our first two points are going to help us to see how different our knowledge and God's knowledge is, and then we're going to think briefly about what it looks like to be like God with Aquinas. So here is Aquinas. Here he's actually quoting Augustine in that kind of way he would quote someone as part of his answer. Augustine, and then Aquinas quoting him, says this: "Not because they are does God know all creatures, spiritual and temporal, but because he knows them, therefore they are." Okay, let's just work out what he's actually just said. The way I know something is, it exists and I see it. So I know what a chair is because a chair exists. I know you because you exist. With God, that works exactly the opposite way around. God knows you, and so you come into existence. God knows of the concept of chair, and so chairs come into existence. There is nothing in the world that God sees and goes, oh, now I know it. He knows it, and therefore it comes into being. It is completely the opposite way around from how our knowledge works. That is a striking thought. That whereas our knowledge kind of flows downstream from existence, God's knowledge predates our existence. He knows it, therefore it comes into being. God knows in a completely different way from us. Whereas his knowledge brings life into existence, our knowledge of God is highly limited. In fact, I mean, our knowledge of anything is highly limited, but particularly of God. Here is Aquinas again. "The infinite cannot be contained in the finite. God exists infinitely, and nothing finite can grasp him infinitely. It is impossible for a created mind to understand God infinitely. It is impossible, therefore, to comprehend him." We thought about this briefly a few weeks ago when we were thinking about those first few verses of Psalm 145. What's he saying? What is finite can never fully understand something that's infinite. We cannot ever get our arms around something that is bigger than any arms could ever fit around. However big a box you have, you cannot put infinite stuff in it. If you have infinite stuff, you could have the biggest box you could possibly make, and it would still never fit infinite stuff in it. We are finite. And so, because God is infinite, we will never fully understand him. His greatness, none of us can fathom. We can know God truly. We do know God truly. We truly know what God is like. We just never know him fully. And we never will, and we should never expect to. And if we could know God fully, that would de-God him. because he would cease to be infinite. It is impossible for a finite creature to fully understand God, and therefore, in eternity, we won't fully understand God either. Even in that most glorious of moments when we see our God face to face, and we suddenly grasp him on a whole new level as we live by sight and not by faith, we will still not fully understand God. Even a million years, a trillion years into eternity, we will never fully understand God because we never will be able to. We will see more and more and more of his goodness and his greatness, but we will never fully understand him. And therefore, time spent pondering God is never wasted time, because there is always more we can learn about him. There is always more of him we can see, because our knowledge of him isn't even scratching the surface of what our God is like. Thirdly, we thought about how God's knowledge is different from our knowledge. Let's just think about how we're like God at all. In Genesis 1, we're told, God says, I will make them in my likeness. Aquinas grapples with that and he says, if God is this great, how could he possibly have people who are like him? In what way could we possibly be like a God this great? He says this, a helpful illustration for us, I think. A statue is like a man, but not the other way around. So also a creature can be spoken of as in some sort like God, but not that God is like a creature. So imagine you go somewhere, I don't know, let's say you go to Blenheim Palace and you see a statue of Winston Churchill. You can say the statue is like Churchill. You wouldn't say, oh, Churchill's quite like that statue. The lesser thing can in some way be like the greater thing. Even though the lesser thing is significantly lesser, that statue can't breathe, it can't talk, it can't think, it can't win a war. But it is in some way like the thing it was molded to be based on. So to us when it comes to God. There are so many ways in which we are not like God, but there are significant ways in which we can be like him. God is never like us. It doesn't work that way round. In the same way that Churchill is never like the statue, so too God is never like us. But we are like him, made in his image. Incredible privilege. Deeply humbling to realize just how little, in a sense, we image God compared to his utter greatness. Our being like him is a true reflection of God. We are showing something real of what God is like. It is a pale reflection, because God is so much greater. God is utterly different from us, says the scriptures, says Aquinas. His greatness no one can fathom. One more time, back in groups, 5 minutes. How has today enlarged your view of the greatness of God? 5 minutes to discuss, and then a few minutes to pray in the light of things you've discussed today in your groups. We're going to turn to sing in praise to our great God, a God who in 1 Timothy 6, Paul describes this way: God, the blessed and only ruler, King of kings and Lord of lords, who alone is immortal and lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. To him be honor and might forever. Amen.